The View from the Fast Lane on a long-awaited appointment at one of the most important titles in fashion. A celebrant of slow journalism explains why the time is now for his particular brand of news coverage, and a word from the weeklies as we head to Spain. Settle in for a half hour of the meatiest media analysis today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Later in the show, our friend Rob Orchard from Delayed Gratification will be here to guide us through issue 25 and to pick apart a few of his own selections from the newsstand. But let's kick things off with more reaction to the announcement in the past week, after something of a hiatus, of a successor to Alexandra Shulman as the editor of British Vogue. Condé Nast chairman Jonathan Newhouse confirmed that Edward Enninful has the job. He'll be taking charge from the 1st of August. Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brûlé joins us on the line right now. From whence do you speak with us, Tyler? I gather you've got quite the vista in front of you.
I do. You can hear the revving of jet engines behind me, Tom, and happy Easter weekend to you, by the way. Yes, I'm standing at the E-gates, so this is the midfield terminal at Zurich Airport, looking out, of course, across the Alps, and some very nice-looking Swiss tails that I believe our friends at Wing Creative might have had a hand in designing and painting. Not that you can, of course, reinvent the Swiss flag that much.
So, Tyler, we're talking about, well, a significant appointment, I guess, in publishing, certainly in fashion, and that's the new broom at Vogue here in the UK, of course. What did you make of this appointment? Because it's got a lot of people talking, many people kind of celebrating the appointment, a man, of course, at the helm for the first time in the magazine's august history. What do you make of it?
It's an interesting appointment, and it's one which has been a very long time coming. When Condé Nast, of course, the parent company of all of the Vogues around the world, announced that Alexandra Shulman was stepping down after quite a reign, I think people thought that Condé Nast would probably have had successorship sorted out quite quickly, and we would have been talking about days or weeks until we would have seen an announcement. But of course, it's been months, and I know firsthand, not that they approached me, Tom, I'm not sure if they approached you for the job, but I was talking to some of the higher-ups at Condé Nast, and even up until a few weeks ago, they were saying, have any candidates in mind? Can you suggest anyone? So I don't want to say that Mr. Enninful, and we're talking about Edward Enninful, the appointed editor, was the third or fifth choice, but it somehow strikes me that there were probably some other candidates maybe further up the ranks, and that is why it took so long. Nevertheless, I think a very interesting appointment, and of course one at a very important time, not just for Vogue, but for glossy magazines in general.
Well, let's talk a bit about the mechanics of this, Tyler, because obviously that's, I think, what people will be reflecting upon later in the summer when he actually gets his feet under the table. How do you manage a succession, particularly where the previous incumbent has been there for so very many years, decades, in fact? There's such an established way of doing things. There's so much, of the office politics, which is shaped by the personality of the predecessor. What does that process look like? And do you necessarily need to sort of take rather a long view?
Well, I think you have to take a long view, but also you have to remember that we're talking about a brand called Vogue and one of the most recognizable mastheads and of course, respected fashion titles in the world. So you come with also some rather strict architecture in many ways as well. Vogue needs to set a fashion agenda, but also Vogue needs to be mindful of commercial constraints. You have quite a heavy layer of management on top. Remember, Condé Nast is a family business and one which has many diverse media interests around the world. But I think that they're going to be looking for an editor who is going to be able to deliver, will excite the advertisers, is going to generate enough press. And press beyond, we're largely, I would say, a B2B program. They have to make sure that people, get very fired up, just like this United Airlines jet is getting fired up behind me here, Tom, right now, to of course, go out and buy or subscribe to the magazine.
And Tyler, maybe just a final point. You mentioned there Condé Nast itself, the parent company, a family concern. Lots of change, you know, senior people. Obviously, we mentioned Jonathan Newhouse, and there's, again, succession stories there. Do you think we should gear up to see, I don't know, big, more significant change, seismic change, even within Condé Nast? Revolution or a fast-paced evolution very much seems to be in the air at the company at the moment.
Yes, there's really there's a lot of real estate moving around. We're seeing the international headquarters. They're moving to a new facility, a large facility, of course, along the Thames in London. And this is obviously the branch of the business which oversees all of the international operations. In the U.S., of course, you know, the most important market for Condé Nast. Yeah, I think a lot of question marks about, you know, how committed are they. Not so much to the print game, but to the large portfolio of titles that they have. And then they've made some very, very big gambles, Tom, beyond the world of editorial, moving into the world of e-commerce in a digital environment. And there are some, you know, big question marks, particularly around the blurring of lines between editorial and commercial, this idea of buying off the page. How much can you use, you know, the Vogue and also other Condé Nast franchises to then go and really directly sell merchandise to consumers, and I think that is a big play, one that many, many publishers are looking at, but I'm not sure if readers at that end of the market are going to be so happy with it.
Indeed. Tyler, great to speak with you as always, and yeah, enjoy the rest of your weekend. Be careful, don't get singed by any of those jets. They sound very adjacent to where you are right now.
Well, hopefully they're not going to melt the Swiss chocolate in the meantime. Have a good Easter.
And to you, Tyler, thanks for your time. This is The Stack, and Rob Orchard is here alongside me in Studio One of Midori House.
Hi, hello.
Rob. Very good to see you again.
Very nice to be here.
Now, I did just mention to you, before we began our record, issue 25.
Yeah, I know, right?
Wow, where's the time gone?
Where has it gone? Six long years.
What? Tell me this question.
Yeah.
Because we've talked before about the slow journalism, the practices behind leg gratification. We'll maybe get back into that in a minute. But did you learn anything different with issue 25 than its 24 predecessors? How about that to start off with?
Wow, that's a cracking question. I don't think I learned anything sort of big. I learned about lots of interesting things, though. So I learned about the Gambian election in a depth that I never thought that I would, but I'm very glad that I did. And I learned all sorts of fascinating facts about Donald Trump and his election victory. And I think I finally learned what the Electoral College is and how it works, which is something that, you know, I'd basically been just sort of pretending that I knew about for a long time. But now I genuinely think I do.
It's eluded many. And yeah. I have to say, there's a handsome full-page portrait.
Of the Commander-in-Chief.
Of the Commander-in-Chief, particularly his sort of helmet hair.
It's sort of glowing.
Tell me about him, though, because I guess something like Trump, and he's so soundbite happy, the whole story with him has moved so quickly. I mean, does an event like that, and then obviously the aftermath of it, make it ever more difficult to, you know, view this world through this prism of, you know, what happened a few months earlier? Or in point of fact, do you think it means the time is more right now than almost ever to have exactly that kind of approach?
Well, that's really interesting. So there are certain Trump stories that it would be daft for us to do something on. So, for example, actually, if we were to do something on his standoff with North Korea, that might be daft because it might well be superseded when the world is plunged into...
I was going to say, World War III would blow that one out of the water. Yeah.
And then we'll look out of date, which would be obviously horrible. But no, so I think isolated events like him becoming president, you can totally go back to and pull to pieces, which is what we've done with a 9-page infographic spectacular, looking at every aspect of how that extraordinary political feat was pulled off. But then I think probably the thing with Trump is, as with kind of most kind of politicians, is there are recurring themes. So actually, I don't think I'll be ruining the next issue when I say that we have just taken consignment of a fantastic long-form piece looking at Mexicans trying to get into the US. And talking to some people who are making this horribly arduous journey through the Sonoma Desert about what the implications are of a Trump presidency. And it's just an absolutely extraordinary story. It seems like back in the 90s, there were far fewer problems with Mexicans coming across and far fewer deaths. So the Sonoma Desert is just an absolute death trap for Mexicans trying to get into the US. And NAFTA appears to have had an influence on the numbers of migrants who are trying to kind of come across. Interestingly also, of course, there's huge stretches of wall in strategic places along the border already, and they have had a massive influence in sort of funneling people through even less pleasant, you know, ways to kind of get there. So that's a way to cover Trump, which is, you know, a big broad story that has its, you know, roots back for 20 years, but that actually has contemporary relevance and won't have changed, you know, by the time the next issue's out.
And tell us a bit more about the whole kind of world of delayed gratification. I mean, do you find you're sort of looking to add additional strings? I mean, it's definitely one of the publications that has a pretty, you know, very keen and committed following. I mean, and you kind of act, I guess, on this idea that you've got a bit of a community around the title, haven't you? I mean, is that still very important as you
that's
move
absolutely,
forward?
That's vital for us. That's vital. We sort of try to think about it as, you know, not being a subscriber, being a member, you know. Somebody put it to us in a very good way, which sounds sort of faintly cultish, but he said very early on, he said, what you need to do is you need to make slow journalism the religion and delayed gratification the Bible. So, you know, this is the thing, you know, this is the thing that you buy because you support this idea and you want to stand behind it. So I think, you know, we've proceeded with that in mind. One of the things that we've done a lot more of is classes. So we have massively increased the number of infographics classes that we run. We're doing how to launch an independent magazine classes. We're looking to add how to be a photojournalist, how to be an investigative reporter, how to be a features writer. There's such interest in this. There's such appetite for it. I think increasingly so, the more sort of unstable and rickety the world looks, in a weird way, the better for us.
No, because I was going to ask you about this, and this is a narrative, I guess, on our news programmes here on Monocle 24 and on the Stack itself. We talk a lot about, you know, obviously the Trump era, and there's this questioning about the veracity of facts that are reported, and people are questioning the objectivity of news outlets, who's funding them, what's the political agenda, and so forth. There seems to be a premium now more than ever on, you know, quality journalism, I guess I'll say, in making those
air quotes. I testify to the air quotes.
But that is important, isn't it? I mean, do you think in a way it strengthens your hand further because, you know, you've made an absolute virtue. It's explicit from the beginning that, look, you know, research, fact-checking, you know, we're not even going to try and report when things are happening. This is your moment, isn't it?
Well, yes, I think so. I think so to a certain extent. And we have seen a big uptick in subscriptions since the referendum and since the US election, both events which have led to these kind of great feelings of instability, but also to, as you say, you know, this torrent of nonsense washing about in the digital sphere. And this feeling that it is incredibly difficult in our very, very time-starved lives to not just be a reader and a consumer, but also to be asked to be an editor and a fact-checker, you know, and a proofreader, because actually, you know, these are functions which have slightly gone by the wayside. But I think that the interesting thing to me, which applies to Monocle as well, is this thing about being print first. Because I think that the sort of the economic underpinning of online journalism, particularly news journalism, it's just, I think, terminally broken now. You know, the advent of, you know, mass use of ad blockers, all of this means that it's almost impossible to fund anything. I was reading this fascinating piece the other day, and I forget where exactly, but they were quoting somebody from Mother Jones as saying that they had put on an investigation that had cost them $350,000 and it won them all sorts of awards, and it had only garnered them $5,000 in online revenue through putting it up online. And of course, that's, you know, that's mathematics that cannot possibly work in the long run. So actually, weirdly, I think this idea of being print first, of saying, well, yes, you know, you can absolutely read our content, but I'm afraid you're going to have to pay for it and it's going to be delivered to you, seems to be something that might work well.
Who knew that was going to be?
Who knew?
Who knew that was, the answer was so elegant and so simple. Well, maybe let's delve into the stack of magazines with you as well. And maybe as we go, we can talk a little bit about how, if at all, they live online, or whether they're online or digital iterations complements or challenges the print.
Fantastic.
What should we start with?
Well, so top of my pile is a magazine called Minor. It's named after the minor bird, and it's about Singapore. And I love it. So this is issue one, and it's a real mishmash of different styles. It's got that classic issue one thing of a magazine where somebody has been storing up, like their first album, storing up all these brilliant ideas in their head, and they almost haven't got the space to put it on. But a few things, kind of lovely design elements. There's something here about these LAN shops where you used to be able to go and play video games with one another, and they kind of style the entire thing up like a 90s computer screen. I love that, that's gorgeous. They've got this fantastic sort of design element that they keep doing, which is where they pull out screenshots and incorporate them into the text. This is fantastic. This is lovely. And clearly, I think they, you know, they were proud of this. So it's called Singapore Bingo Western Journalism Edition. And what they do is they've got this lovely grid of things and you just tick them off when you see it being used in Western journalism. So chewing gum ban, tax haven, Disneyland with a death penalty, swamp to metropolis, all that sort of thing. And then some really interesting features. So there's a feature where somebody from something called Project Synthesis has given a bunch of disposable cameras to migrant workers in Singapore and ask them to just take photos of whatever interests them and then kind of, you know, reporting back with that. So I think it's really interesting. And of course, you do have, you know, this image in the West of Singapore as being this very uptight, super clean, super sort of rigid society. Mm. But of course, you know, that's never the whole, the entirety of any society. And this is just, you know, kind of a glorious plunging in to look at all of the different elements that might go to make this idiosyncratic place up. I really like it. I'd be really interested to see how it settles down in future issues as well.
Very nice. We set the bar very high.
Where should we go next?
So
this is interesting. So this has just come through with my my subscription to Stack magazines. And I like it very much. So this is Real Review, number 3. It's an architecture magazine. I've not had time to get properly to grips with it because it's only just arrived. There's one story in there that I absolutely love. It takes a certain amount of chutzpah to write this sort of story, but it's a story, decent size, all about air conditioning at airports. As it turns out, it's this fascinating engineering and practical story. I'll just read you a little bit actually here that I highlighted. So it says 2 degrees between 20 and 22 degrees Celsius. That marks the difference between a population of people who are cold and sluggish or hot and bothered. The psychological effects of this thermal range are not dissimilar to the plot of the film Speed, in which a bus can't slow down or it will explode. Except that in this case, there's an even more violent consequence to breaching the upper limit, irritable, stressed and potentially irrational airport passengers. And there's one other touch in this that I really like. It's an architecture magazine, and what they've tried to do is re-engineer the architecture of a magazine. And what they've spotted is that with a saddle stitch magazine like this, people are very often reading it, kind of just holding it with one hand, and maybe they're on the tube or the train and they're kind of crammed in. So you can actually fold this magazine in half and just read through like this. So it's almost like a half-size magazine. Now, if you open it up, you get lots and lots of additional content, but you can just kind of flick through and just read through on the right.
This is genius.
It's nice, isn't it?
It's very elegant.
Yeah.
And it's almost got a kind of, I don't know, slightly kind of zany look about it, which is maybe trying to challenge, again, a possible preconception that the world of architecture can be a little starchy or a bit stiff.
But
it's great fun. And if there's an accordion style construction element involved.
Yeah, exactly. Always nice. You know, they've got the courage of their convictions. Mm. They are assured writers. There's lots of words in there. You know, it's quite densely packed, but that's good. And it feels to me like the sort of magazine that will gain a really, really strong following of people who are totally devoted to it. And, you know, can't wait for their kind of next copy.
What's next?
What have we got here? Okay, so this is not a new magazine, but it's interesting to me. So this is Sidetracked magazine, and it is part of that genre of exploration and travel magazines that has kind of sort of seen a kind of a huge crop of things come up recently.
Now, it's a well-served sector.
Yes, it is.
Now, some might even say it's too well-served, if such a thing were possible. where does this sort of fit in that busy landscape?
Well, so that's really interesting. So I think that a huge amount of magazines like this are terribly pretentious and self-indulgent, and they make me not like the people who've gone off and done it. And you know, there's quite a lot of them where it's just, you know, they've very obviously been on a freebie, and it's just like, oh, you know, Rithi Rai in the Maldives is it's a great place for adventure. No, it's not. It's absolutely not. You just sat there and, you know, like drank cocktails all week. But this is proper. So this is, well, firstly, the photography is insanely wonderful and properly. And I generally haven't got magazines before, you know, where you just want something to kind of flick through and just kind of gorge on the imagery. And it's quite often seemed to me to be just kind of a way of filling up space, but not so this. I mean, the photos they get are sensational. As a man with two very young children, you know, kind of the most exciting thing I ever do is occasionally go to Lyon for lunch or something. And there's a guy here who's got himself smuggled to the Chernobyl exclusion zone in Ukraine and has kind of hiked in towards the reactor. Yeah, fair play to him. That is that. You know, that's a sensational story, and that's good effort.
Yeah, that's and that's proper work.
That's proper work.
That's putting a shift in. There's peril.
There's peril involved. Exactly. Yeah, but I would say that for me is the absolute pinnacle of this genre of magazine. They've got everything right. The production values are just kind of gorgeous. The images, I know how difficult it is to source really beautiful images. The kind of care and attention that's gone into this is extraordinary.
It's interesting. And yet, it does, in a funny way, it's not dissimilar from what I imagine maybe some of the titles that you are not such a fan of that you're alluding to, in the sense we've got, it's quite clean, it's quite traditional, we have these broad white borders around the images. So it's not sort of trying to rewrite the way to make an attractive magazine.
True. That's absolutely true.
But it's got a bit more kind of sort of editorial heft,
I
really,
wonder
behind
if it's,
it.
If it's the way that it's written. There seems to be sort of a bit of honesty in there. Yeah, I think you can generally tell if somebody's faking it for freebies. And these dudes absolutely and categorically aren't. Yeah, you don't want 10 of these, but actually one of these coming through and reminding you that there may be more to life than just going to kind of the adventure playground, you know, 12 times a week is good.
I'm probably up at about 15 times a week in terms of adventure playground visits. Right, well, spring, summer it is. Delayed gratification 25, wrapping up the last 3 months, of course, of 2016. What's ahead? What are you getting most excited about, Rob? I mean, I never know with, you know, how far gone are we with issues 26 and so on and so on. What's kind of what's round the corner in your
world? So we're relatively early on with issue 26. We're playing around with lots of ideas, which is absolutely my favourite bit. So we've come out of the sort of the
this
Miles
is the
Strum.
Easier part. Really,
this is the nicer bit. This is about sort of having a coffee in the sunshine. We're like, should we send somebody to Switzerland? Yes, maybe. and then, you know, sort of cut to 2 weeks' time. And it's like, right, why haven't they gone to Switzerland?
Somebody needs to decide.
Go to Switzerland. So we've got lots and lots of stories coming in. We've got some beautiful potential stories, some interesting stuff from Venezuela, from a country that's kind of in meltdown. At the moment, we have some potential fascinating stories from Gabon, this extraordinary story that's just come in from the Sonoma Desert. So all sorts of nice things like that. We're also working on some infographics, which, as you know, is kind of our sort of stock in trade. So we're working on my favourite infographic we do, which is the butterfly effect in each issue, where we trace some kind of like tiny event in the past, some tiny insignificant event that leads to some massive, great, big event in our recent quarter. Yeah, and we're also on the hunt for cover art. So I was really pleased with the cover art this time. The artist is somebody that you will no doubt recognise as a children's illustrator, Oliver Jeffers. And he does brilliant books, including this fantastic one called The Boy Who Ate Books, which is all about this kid who starts eating books and then he gets the knowledge from the books and he becomes the smartest kid in the world. And it's just so well illustrated. But he's also a fine artist. And so we were just delighted when we found that. And the kind of the cover, which is this sort of pastoral scene with in the centre of it this satellite that has smashed down and fallen to Earth, just for us kind of really captured how we were feeling in that last quarter of last year when Trump became president and all of the things that we thought were going to happen didn't happen. And suddenly we sort of lost our bearings. Yes, we're at the fun bit.
Yeah. Watch this space.
Yeah, exactly.
We will
right.
do with interest. Rob, a delight to chat with you as always.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks for coming to see us.
Thanks so much.
Now, as we do every week on the programme, it's time for the weeklies, when we look at some of our favourite weekly magazines around the world. This time we're heading to Spain to take a look at El País Semanal, which comes every weekend with the El País newspaper. The paper's certainly one of the most respected print publications from Spain. For a little taster on what's in the issue this week, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the El País deputy editor, Maite Rico, who's also in charge of their weekend edition.
Maite, first of all, tell us a bit more about your job. Since when were you part of the El País team?
Well, El País, I'm a journalist here, a reporter since 1989 already, and I've been mainly international desk and correspondent in Latin America, and I've been covering also different conflicts, wars in Bosnia, Libya, and after that I went to opinion desk. And I've been here in this post as weekend editor since 2014, for 3 years now.
Amazing. And now you're also in charge of the weekend edition of the paper. Tell us a bit more about El País Semanal, which is, the weekly magazine supplement that you just mentioned there. How does the magazine complements the weekend edition?
Well, the El País Semanal was born 40 years ago at the same time as the newspaper, 41 actually, and it was a complement to the Sunday contents of El País, in the sense that it's the home for deep reporting that hasn't had place normally in the newspaper, great and long interviews to the main characters, and articles of the best writers on the Spanish language, either from Spain or Latin America, as well as we give a lot of importance to the photography. So it's kind of a magazine that you can have it for the rest of the week and have a deeper insight on subjects.
And one thing that comes across to me in El País and El País Semanal as well is, even though it's a Spanish publication, it is very, very international. You know, I'm Latin American myself. You know, sometimes at the British papers, you don't see, you know, such that diversity of international stories. And I think, do you think that's one of your aims at El País as well and in the magazine, to be very international?
No, absolutely. El País, the whole group, but especially El País, has focused in the last years in Latin America. And we have a paper edition there, and we are growing online also there. We have at least 70 people working in the Latin America and United States. So, yeah, Latin America is very important for us. It's like half of our audience now. It's also a kind of historical and cultural relationship, but El País Semanal, we try to take into account also Latin American content and also writers. So, yeah, we are growing together from some years ago, and that is going to continue. Yeah, it's really important for us.
Tell us what's on the cover of the upcoming edition of El País Semanal in this Easter weekend.
We have a strange cover in the sense that we renew the design, and we have two main contents in the same front page. The main one, which is called From Jihad to Reggaeton, is about the process of radicalization of young Muslims in Spain. In this case, are two brothers who were recruited by ISIS. When they were 16 years old, they stopped by police on the way to Syria, and now, well, under state control, they are trying to rebuild their lives. But it's curious, yeah, we were the first country to be hit by terrorism in Madrid, and since then, we have exactly the same problems as other countries. It happens with France or Belgium, based from recruitment from young men, Muslim men, to go to Syria. So yes, it's something that has come very quickly, and we have been used, unfortunately, to terrorism with the Basque group ETA, and now the terrorism is from other side, which is Islamic terrorism.
Finally, Maitea, just a final question about El País Semanal. Cool, we're talking about, you know, this very serious news stories, but as you've mentioned, you do cover sometimes design and perhaps a little bit of fashion as well?
Yes, El País Semanal is, we call in Spain, generalista, the magazine for a general reader. That's actually a problem because we have to do a lot of equilibrium to balance the content. Above all, our DNA is deep journalism, wide scope, and reporting and interviews. But at the same time, we have to include sections of lifestyle, fashion, beauty, also in order to have advertising. So we try to combine hardcovers with soft ones. We are also doing a lot of things about science and technology, culture. It's like a big window to the world. And the aim is to surprise the reader with original subjects and interesting people.
That was Maite Rico from El País talking to Fernando earlier. And that's all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks, as ever, to our production team of Ben Ryland and Fernando, and of course to our editor, Claire Aban. Comments or queries are welcome. Drop Faye a note. You can find him at fp@monocle.com, and don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.